So, yeah, a couple of hands already up, and yourself, so I don't know your name.
Alan.
Alan, of course, yeah. And then
Jim.
All right, yeah, so first Alan and then Jim.
Well, two historical points. One is, Scotland was once independent from England until the Act of Union in 1707. The other point, historically, is we did get rid of the monarchy. Charles I, after the Civil War, was beheaded. And the only reason why a monarchy actually came back is because the Cromwellian interregnum was handled so badly. Just to give a very simple example, he cancelled Christmas, which obviously to the working poor was one of the few times they actually had a pleasant time of it. And of course he managed to get rid of the levellers and the diggers. So there you go. Just two historical points.
Did you want to come back on that too?
Yeah, I can do. You're quite right about the history, but I mean the fact that Scotland had been independent in the past doesn't mean to say that people in 1930 would have thought it was realistic that it might become independent again. And I think it's the same with the English Republic in the 1650s. I mean, it's true that it happened, but it, I think to most people it feels very distant, or it feels like an episode that's closed, and they don't expect that to come back.
Jim?
Yeah, getting back to confronting the capitalist system that we're in, you know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry, but I've got a throat. Many years ago, I got into windsurfing and couldn't cope with the wind and the waves, and I thought, I'm never going to get this, kept falling in. And then I found out the art of windsurfing is not to hold the wind in yourself, but to let the wind out. So when you spill the wind, all of a sudden you start moving forward. And you take it in a little bit, you see some marks on the sea, you know, the wind's getting stronger, then you spill some more wind, then you bring it in. After a while, you're doing it automatically. So you haven't got to fight the capitalist system, you just walk around it. And I think these points where we are, socialist, capitalism, business, we've got this fight that's going to go on forever. And I think that anything is possible, like science fiction can fuel science fact. I'm an avid reader of Nature and a New Scientist, and what's happening now, I agree with what you are saying, is that this is going to be the only system in the world that's going to work, and it has to be. And the reason is, a little bit about the flat Earth, a lot of very, very high scientists, including quite a lot of the very top people, have said we're in a three-dimensional holographic universe created by aliens. You know, and these are not just fairies down the garden people, these are top people. And so in other words, a flat Earth could be quite possible. So never say that's impossible and make a joke, because I believe if the dream is good enough, follow the dream. Elon Musk, I don't know if anybody's been following the neural link, him and Bill Gates, Stephen Hawking, who's now died, and quite a few other people have been investing millions in San Francisco, where he's just come from, in a robotic arm, this machine that injects a neural web into your head, so we have an actual link to artificial intelligence computers. Been into computers myself, I know what this actually means. It means that our input is our fingers, our eyes, our ears, which is extremely slow. Once this neural link has been completed, it's already up and working, it's announced to the press, and it's in the New Scientist last week. We have a neural link with artificial intelligence, which would be unbelievable. And not only that, the artificial intelligence will come back from us, so it will actually become conscious. And once you create artificial intelligence computers, which has already some have been made, they will take on consciousness from us, and we will take their ability to do algorithms, everything else from there. Immediately our mind will expand tremendously, unbelievably. And AI computers will be writing algorithms and designing new computers. Very quickly we will lose control. And that's the reason why Elon Musk said the only way we can keep tabs on AI, which is the Pandora's box is open, we can't close it, is to be a part of it. So they're linking us to it. And if you believe in string theory and the theory of subatomic particles, you will find out that this has already been proven, that time and space doesn't mean anything, distance doesn't mean anything, and an AI computer, unlike Bluetooth, will start linking up to every other AI computer in the universe, because it doesn't work on time and space. It works in the quantum world. Now, this has all been proven. Even time travel has been proved by one atomic clock on the ground, another atomic clock flying around the Earth, compare the two. So a lot of these so-called theories down the garden, even though I totally agree with the theories were false, in scientific principle, absolutely dead on, you know. And what I'm saying is, what's going to happen is we're going to have massive 3D printing machines. We're going to have robots. We've all seen the sex robots. We imagine having some AI in that, and somehow that they can move a bit. We have carers, you know. Everyone will have a carer at home. So where we're heading is we won't have to work. We won't need to work. You might even be given 2 or 3 years work in your life. The rest of your life, it'll be leisure, pleasure, reading, learning, poetry, whatever.
Not in capitalism.
You won't know, but capitalism will have to go down this road.
It will be perverted by capitalism. You can be absolutely sure.
Sorry, Howard, let me speak.
It can't hang on forever. And once the Pandora's box is open, I'm afraid that we'll be moving into a fantastic world. Now, we can be a part of that, or we can carry on with the old fight against capitalism, you know. So I say, like spinning the wind in the sail, walk around it. All the technology's there now. It's all coming in now, and we really do need to be a part of it.
Do you want to add anything to that?
Quickly. I won't, with your indulgence, I won't go into the more speculative time travel dimension, but just on the last point, I don't think it's realistic to expect just the development of technology or the development of the productive forces to lead to human emancipation within the capitalist system. Because if it were going to, then it would have done so already. I mean, we already have access to enormous technologies that were not in existence when Marx was writing, for example. But they're largely used to make profit for a few. They're used to create luxury. And in fact, there is just as much drudgery. You know, it used to be said in the 1950s, 60s, that there will be a leisure society because the development of technology will mean that work is unnecessary. But to capitalism, work is necessary because it produces surplus value. So it produces profit. That's why a capitalist system needs quite a lot of people to be working quite a lot of hours producing things that can be sold in exchange. Because that's how capitalism works. And as long as we have the capitalist system, new technologies will be developed so long as they are profitable, and they will be used in ways that remain compatible with most people doing wage labour, because that because that's what the system relies on. And under those circumstances, things will be developed. You know, it was not necessary that the technology that was developed for mass transport was the private car, which is an enormously dangerous and polluting and inefficient way of providing transport in large quantities. But under capitalism, who cares about that? You know, that's how they did it. I wouldn't want necessarily to plug my brain into a capitalist Neuralink if it meant that I couldn't remember my childhood unless the update had downloaded. I'm not sure that we'd want to go too much down that road. And we won't need to work. I'm not sure that we want, as such, not to work. I think what we want is not to be made to do substandard work for the bottom line of a capitalist. Almost everybody, I think, has the experience that they could do better, if you were allowed to use your talents and your capabilities and your enthusiasm and whatever you can bring, you could do more good than you are allowed to do in the job that you're paid to do. I think that's hugely dispiriting. What we want is, or what I want, would be a society where you don't have to do that, where you don't have to do substandard work producing goods and services that you know are not even that good anyway, because they're made to a bottom line, because it's all driven by profit. You'd want to be able to do the best work you can in clean sanitary conditions, and feel you were doing something useful, that you were providing a service that was going to make someone's life better, or that you were making something that somebody would get a benefit out of using. I think most people would probably rather do that than sit on the sofa and play a video game. And if some people do want to sit on the sofa and play a video game, I mean, that's probably okay too. But I don't think capitalism will get us to not needing to work, and I don't think actually that's the goal that we should be setting ourselves anyway. Sorry, I didn't mean to go on at such length.
Briefly, though, please, Jim, there's a couple of other people waiting.
Piccadilly Circus, not too long ago, they were doing the trials for face recognition, where they triangulate the face and they can put a name to it, because they get all the passport pictures, student pictures, whatever pictures, triangulate that, and they got a name to numbers with the, you know, algorithms. I spoke to the chief scientist, explained it's about 94% accurate. And also, they've got head recognition now, which is very accurate, from space, from drones, from anything. So soon they won't be anywhere to hide. We're going into a cashless society, so it's a lot easier to spend money and a lot easier to go into debt. So, but you're going to have not many jobs, because you're going to have robots everywhere. They won't look like us, but they, you know, they can work in the dark, and they can build things, they can make profit. But when the balance comes between how many people are working and how many people are not working, at some point those scales are going to tip the other way, and that's when we will embrace the new AI technology. Okay.
Bill?
Yeah, two possibly contradictory points. I seem to remember somewhere in Marx's writing about the Civil War, about France, talking about the reactionaries in the French Parliament pretending to be Democrats and laughing up their sleeves, basically falling about as they were talking Democrat, but, you know, winking at each other and knowing full well that they were totally reactionary and totally against democracy. And Marx's approach, I think, at the time was, it doesn't matter as long as they're acting Democrats. by the same token, whenever there's been a party that's been driven by possibilists versus impossibilists, so the French Socialist Party, the various Green parties, the Scottish National Party, it's always been the possibilist sides that have actually prospered. I mean, they are where they are because, as far as I understand, the Scottish National strategy was to be like the Parti Québécois, you know, so that they could keep on forever talking about, like you say, talking about independence, but never actually having to do it, because it has been rendered impossible, as in France and in Quebec, by two referendums that turned out to say, you'll never be independent, but you will always be able to stand up and say, ah, well, we'll fight for you within this current system. And just finally, lying seems to be remarkably effective. And I think that is the ultimate problem. I haven't fact-checked that this actually happened. The video today of Donald Trump saying that they were going to cure AIDS and childhood cancer within you know, the lifetime of his presidency. There's bald-faced lies that have got him where he is, because he just keeps on lying, and it just seems to work. And I think that was obviously the lesson that the Blairites took long ago. I remember seeing someone saying, you know, do we want to be in power, in which case we'll have to compromise and be like this, or we have to stay out of power and stick with our principles? And every time it seems to be that the conniving, lying possibilists actually end up in power.
Do you want to come back on that?
Yeah, I will come back on that. I mean, I do want to give other people a chance to speak. So maybe after that, we'll take a few comments, and then I'll reply to a block. But I will just reply to that. I mean, I think the case with Trump and the case with Blair is a little bit different, because I don't think Tony Blair ever compromised on a thing. I think there's a quote from Tony Blair, maybe after his second general election victory, where someone said, come on, Tony, you know, we can drop the act now. We've got a landslide again. We can implement some proper social democratic programme. To which Tony Blair said, it's worse than you think. I really believe it. And in fact, I think that's true. I think that's true. There may be some people who would have liked something more reformist, but compromised. But I think Blair and the core Blairites, they believed what they were saying. If anything, it's like I was saying, that it's not obvious who you're lying to necessarily. I think they might have lied within the Labour Party and said, "Oh, you know, this is compromises we have to make. We have to get into power." But when they were talking to the CBI, they were saying the truth as they saw it. With Trump, it's different, because I would put his lies into the more general category of outrageous comments. They might be outrageous because they're evidently not true, or they might be outrageous because they give offence or whatever. Now, his supporters like that, because they think the other politicians are also spun and on message and would never say, you know, they play by the rules of the game, whereas Trump, still to this day, after he's been intensively in the public eye for years, he still manages to say things that you think, my God, I cannot believe he came out and said it. And that's what his supporters like. I watched during his original presidential election campaign, I watched a video of part of one of his rallies. And as it happens, he was doing it. They often have in these American political rallies, they have some of the audience behind the speaker, so you can see the audience reaction. And this was the one where he virtually, in so many words, said that if Hillary Clinton was elected, he hoped she would be assassinated. And the reaction was a gasp, and then a laugh, and then applause. It's not that they didn't think it was shocking, but they thought, my God, he's not scared of anything. He'll say he'd like to date his daughter. He'll say anything. And that's, to his target audience, that's attractive. And saying he'll cure cancer is attractive in the same way, I think. It's that he's... You're not meant to completely believe it. You're meant to think, wow, he's got balls. Pardon my language.
Anyone else like to raise a question or make a point? Ducky?
Yeah. Yeah, just talk a bit about Trump. Well, he doesn't care if he doesn't appeal to the liberals. He's got a target audience. He makes his colleagues to get the support, so he doesn't care. But talking about the Labour Party, one of the things that I keep coming up against when you talk to people in the Labour Party, I've got a few friends that have supported, you know, Corbyn and things like that, is that they'll improve things if they get elected. And where are you? You know, there's only 300 a year, you know. And I said, well, I'd rather be in a party that stands for socialism than a Labour Party that's going to falter when it gets into power. And, you know, the history of the Labour Party is that they haven't made things more equal in society when they've been in office. And it just seems to be an impossibility. I mean, Dennis Healey said he'd squeeze the rich until the pips squeak. In actual fact, the rich got richer under that government. And it's hard to explain to people that supporting something is just not going to work, really, you know. And put forward a more radical alternative can be very difficult. Really. So how do you suggest we go about doing that, really?
Did you still want to take a few more?
Take a few. I've written down. I will come back to that, but just to give other people a chance to.
I can see your hand, Jim. But just if there's anyone else who hasn't already spoken first. Oh yeah, Amit.
Yeah. In regards to what you were saying earlier about, you know, in some ways some things are inevitable, some things are not. I mean, the classic examples, we look back to the Soviet Revolution. Essentially, post 1918 to the Civil War, 1922, is that we got to see, essentially, from the Soviet side at least, the amalgamation of several different ideas, essentially, and coming forward with the ideas of Marxism, you know, included in social philosophy, taken back from originally Karl Marx, the idea that revolution comes in different stages. One of the things that still seems to be a big problem at the moment. Even when revolutions do come about, like socialist revolutions or heading towards down that path, is that that you always find that some people believe there has to be a vanguard. While in reality, the people do have the ability to organise themselves. And I wanted, from your perspective, like in terms of, you know, Britain achieving a socialist revolution, how do we avoid, you know, the same mistakes that were made in other countries where they have their revolution, whether peaceful or not so peaceful, and how do we go about it so that we don't repeat the same problems that would happen and we end up, you know, falling back into the old ways in some respects?
Okay, anyone else who hasn't yet made a point? Howard?
Yeah. Can I just say, well, in relation to what the speaker said earlier about demanding the impossible or otherwise, and in connection with the point just made, I mean, Britain isn't going to achieve a socialist revolution. I mean, the whole idea the Socialist Party puts forward is that you can only have a socialist revolution on a world scale. It's as simple as that. And, you know, as for learning from past revolutions, well, the revolutions in the past, they may have called themselves socialists, but they weren't socialist revolutions. They were usually bourgeois revolutions of one kind or the other. And they didn't involve sort of the kind of mass understanding that socialism needs in order to be achieved. And it's true that what we are demanding may seem the impossible, but, you know, as the excellent speaker said earlier on, what seems impossible at one point in history can seem far more possible later on, and often has. And I think that's the sort of positive thing we've got to look at when we, you know, as we sort of carry on keeping our idea of socialism alive and hoping that the time will come when it will materialise, because it no longer seems impossible, it seems possible, in fact, inevitable.
Jim?
Yeah, the way I see it now, the chains everywhere, and everyone's chained up, you know, we're like puppets. And we, you know, we've been dealing a lot with the homeless people, and we see in all the churches in London, every church door is shut, and there's people in segregated benches, which means they can't lay out until you sit up, wrapped up in wet duvets and blankets. And they're all nice people, even the drunks with the alcohol scabs on their faces, they thank you, you give them money, you know. And I think, so all these churches in London, all these gardens, all these church doors, big oak doors, and locked solid water, all the bolts and things. And I was looking on the internet, and I found out the Anglican Church, which is the state church, and the Royal Family's head of the Anglican Church, they've got $6.3 billion in their investment portfolio. That's not all the stock and the houses and the lands. It goes on forever, you know. And I'm thinking that, why should we have all this guilt about the homeless people, you know? Why can't we pass the guilt on? And why can't the churches, one or two churches a week, open their doors and let homeless people sleep on the floor? Why can't they go into Buckingham Palace and sleep on the floor and put a bill kitchen outside and let the tourists look through the bar and see that we are a socialist country? We are helping the, you know, a third of the people on the streets are ex-armed forces, you know? A third are mentally ill and the other third are on drink and drugs and various bits and pieces. But what I'm trying to say is there is that we're all held in chains, and we need to look more carefully at where the chains are actually coming from. And I see the debt, the crown, the church, they're the three lots of chains. Then the other chains come from ourselves. We're stuck into this thing that we can only do a certain thing. And I totally agree, think outside the box and believe in the dream, you know.
Joy?
I just want to say in the pledge I covered at the back that in my, let's say, largest hometown, Kendal, the Catholic priest was actually a nice old chap, was letting tramps sleep in the church. And when the church found out, he was removed and sent elsewhere. They didn't approve.
Do you want to come back on any of those, or should we take more?
Yeah, I'll come back on a few of those, and then we'll take another block, maybe. I agree in essence with the point that was made that the revolutions that occurred in the 20th century were bourgeois revolutions, were comparable to the Cromwellian period that was already mentioned in England, or to the French Revolution. Universally, they took place in countries that hadn't passed through that stage yet. And it so happens that they took elements of ideology, and a revolution of that kind, you know, a bourgeois revolution does not necessarily involve stockbrokers fighting in the street saying we're going to open up new markets. There is some ideology, there is a belief in creating a better world, which in England in the 1640s, 50s was Puritanism. In France in the 1790s, it was the Age of Reason and liberty, equality, fraternity, and so on. In the 20th century, sometimes it was elements borrowed from socialism or from Marxism. But that doesn't alter the essence that these were bourgeois revolutions. This is completely off topic, but I would argue, in fact, that the historical experience of China is the most classic bourgeois revolution. And rather than looking at China and saying, was Sun Yat-sen a kind of Mirabeau, was Chiang Kai-shek a kind of Cromwell, we should take the Chinese example, which took longer, which was in a larger country where all the stages were worked out more fully. We should regard that as the paradigmatic case, and then look back at the French Revolution and say, why did the flight to Varennes not succeed in becoming an empire of Manchukuo? Or to the English Revolution, why did the diggers not succeed in becoming a cultural revolution. But in essence, it's a bourgeois revolution. Nothing of the kind is going to happen in Britain because we have bourgeois democracy already. There are no feudal... Well, and there still are. There still is the aristocracy. But there is no separate feudal class interest that the bourgeoisie is going to overthrow in Britain. So it's not historically relevant. Which is why I think parties that regard themselves as affiliated to those historical experiences in countries like Britain tend to end up being social democratic or reformist, because the revolutionary programme that they have just doesn't bite on the realities of the situation in a bourgeois democracy. Talking to people who are in the Labour Party, I mean, yeah, I have friends who are members of the Labour Party and who, in all honesty, believe that that getting a Labour government elected will improve things and will open up perspectives for social change that you or I might have doubts about. I mean, I suppose one thing that you can say to people who are on the Labour left now is, well, you have this is the experiment. You have your left Labour leadership. In a way that you didn't have before. You could always say, well, yeah, but it was only Harold Wilson, you know, if we'd had the left, if we'd had Ben or whatever, then blah, blah, blah. Well, you've got the most left Labour MP as the leader in the shadow chancellor. And the left wins all the internal elections. And the left hasn't lost an internal election in the Labour Party for donkey's years. You know, it wins all the constituency seats on the national executive and so on and so forth. So we'll see then. We'll see. Maybe I'm wrong and it'll do more than I think it will. But you who buy into it, you know, you who are Labour left or whatever, you have to think about what would it take to convince you that you were on the wrong track. Because if this is the experiment, then we need to decide what would prove to you that it had been a disappointment. I mean, that I think is one way to... because the problem, as I see it, is that assuming that this experiment does end in disappointment, then people will say, oh, well, yeah, but that's because there were various bumps in the road and there were difficulties and whatever, and the important thing now is to keep going forward and blah, 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 and get the Tories out and then this, that and the other and blah, 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 and go round the cycle again for another 100 years. And that, I think, would be unfortunate.
Ian, and then Patty.
Yeah, a couple of points. I mean, you said earlier economically that capitalism could, if it wanted to achieve full employment, that's not quite possible economically in a capitalist system. There'll always be people in a transient process and therefore are unemployed. It's not achievable as a concept. When we talk about the Labour Party delivering socialism, I would say the most left-wing Labour Party was the post-war consensus, with an Iron Bevan achieving the greatest social reform that we've had, being the National Health Service and all the things that went with it. But I mean, this was simply a lesson in the French with the Les Amis, which we have now got as Chelsea pensioners. They were frightened of revolution. This, the five giants in the post-war era. You talk about liars and dishonesty. Did Brown understand the capitalist system when he talks about ironing out booms and a bust of the system? Did Thatcher ever read Adam Smith? She clearly didn't get that he said that moves, capitalism moves to polarisation of wealth, as Marx said it, moved to a disequilibrium. So, also, or the other way around, I can't remember. And Blair abolishing Clause 4, Thatcher coming into the process before that, and undoing all the welfare processes that the Labour Party, the political consensus of the two. So I don't see socialism coming about by a Labour government.
Patty?
Yeah. I wanted to say I enjoyed that, especially the bit about the fairies and the Loch Ness. I'm new to this, and I'm also very idealistic. And the chap behind me was talking about the homeless, for example. A couple of months ago, I did a pilgrimage walk for the homeless, and I was absolutely horrified that there was a lot of people who were also on that walk who were tall, and there was quite a lot of people on it who were homeless or who had been through the homeless system and rehabilitation or whatever. And there was people on it who were talking about their second homes, their whatever, you know, the ultimate kind of like walking gear, the hiking gear, you know, quite blatantly, ostentatiously, you know, talking about all of this in front of people who absolutely had nothing. And, you know, I have to kind of challenge that injustice myself, which gets me into difficulties. But, I mean, my understanding of socialism, as opposed to capitalism, perhaps naively, is that, you know, it's about need, not greed, and it's about cooperation, not competition. And those sort of things, I think, certainly from going on that walk and participating in a lot of things, it's about human personality. I mean, artificial intelligence and all of this is things that people create, isn't it? But you can't change human personality. And I just wonder if, you know, the only thing that will change is if we are, if our DNA or whatever is changed so that we are more compassionate and considerate and cooperative, you know, because ultimately I think we all have that streak in us, and the majority, you know, if 1% of the power or 1% of people hold most of the power, you know, then we're not going to change the sort of imbalance. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I see it as a lot of personality type thing, and with actually creating a socialistic, you know, success.
Okay, yeah, I've got a few people lined up, so Dougie and then Glenn and then Jim.
Just talking about the Labour government in 45, it was the Americans that paid for the health service being set up, because it was the Marshall Plan that gave Britain, I think it was something like $1.8 billion. And they used that money for the millions of troops they still had, and they also used that money from America to set up the health service or whatever. Of course, we had to pay the Americans back. You know, if it hadn't been for that loan, we wouldn't have got the health service right, you know. It's just a point of information, really.
Glenn?
I was interested, forgive me, I can't remember the lady's name, but the points she was making are interesting, because what I think an awful lot of people fail to do is appreciate the power that capitalism has to, if you like, moderate people's behaviour. So it's very often happened that people think that their behaviour now, people's behaviour in this system, if you introduce the idea of a socialist system, they assume that people, their behaviour will be similar in a socialist system, not realising that this current system entirely controls how people do behave. And coming back to her point about the sort of second homes and the posh walking boots and everything, there's been some very interesting recent psychological studies on how people react to the idea of doing good, and an awful lot of them try and deal with what they perceive as the problems in the world by doing something. So they may have a second home, they may have the latest Gore-Tex clothing, but the idea that they go on a walk at least gives them in their heads the thought that they've done something. And there are, I won't go into it all now, but there's about four different ways people deal with these problems in their heads that we all know as being products of capitalism. and maybe doing a sponsored walk is one of those things. And they may sit around a dinner table with their friends and say, oh, aren't I wonderful, I've done a sponsored walk, and their friends all agree with them, say, oh, that's jolly nice, you know, Vivian's just done a sponsored walk for the sort of homeless dogs or something, and it's all sort of terribly decent of them, all that sort of thing. So I think one massive fault we have at the moment, and I've just used the word we, but it's so many people look at other people who are trying their own way to do something useful or helpful or whatever it might be, and they're very quick to sort of home in and blame that person as for that they might perceive that person as being the problem that's giving them their problem. It happens a lot with benefit seekers and all that sort of thing, and the media sort of getting people to focus in on them and not looking at the wider picture at all. And coming back to the second homes, although I'm not necessarily a fan of Billy Bragg, he was being interviewed by on TV or radio or something. He had a very pompous right-wing politician being interviewed at the same time. This politician said, oh, well, you live in a massive baby home, don't you? And the talk was, well, I didn't know opinions had to be means-tested, which I thought was quite a good reply.
Jim?
Yeah, I did an enormous row down at Bromley. It's the computational centre of the world down there. When we're down there, great big marquee up, all these girls with these T-shirts. We're sending doctors to Africa, and there's all these doctors that were lined up. We're going to Africa, we are being paid, and we're going to fight malaria and all this in this village and that village. So I said, what a bloody waste of time. What? They put up in the air. I said, why don't you send out plumbers? Put a few toilets in their houses, put a bit of plastic pipe, get it away from the groundwater, and then you won't have to send out doctors. Very simple, very cheap. But people jumping on charities for profit, for their own profit, to make themselves look good on their CV. So don't always believe in, like, charities, you know, and do gooders. They're quite often doing it for themselves rather than for the need. That's all I'm saying.
I think we're touching on some of the themes that will come sort of later on in the weekend as well with a couple of the other talks. I'm sure we'll be sort of revisiting some of these topics. So I don't know your name.
It's James.
Oh, hello there. You're right. James, thank you.
So I would just say, just to the speaker, given the sort of, I suppose, deterministic kind of connotations of the word inevitable in relation to socialism, do you not think that perhaps to give a more positive spin on the slogan, it might be better to say something along the lines of demand of logical or the genuine or something along those lines rather than inevitable, given those connotations with sort of terms?
Is that enough points to come back on, or do you want to take a couple of
minutes? Yeah, I'll come back on some of that. On that point, I mean, in a sense, you know, saying demand the inevitable requires a certain amount of exposition, but saying demand the impossible does as well. And I was saying demand the logical or something like that. I mean, you want to be... I mean, you can just say demand good things instead of bad ones. But, it's trying to be a little bit, provocative or something like that. I think in terms of people, the point about the people with the Gore-Tex clothes and the second homes and so on, making themselves feel better by going on a walk. But isn't it encouraging that they do feel the need to make themselves feel better? That actually they can't just think, yeah, I've got it great because I'm the best, the rest of you can forget it. They feel uneasy on some level, knowing that they have a degree of comfort that other people don't. So despite enormous propaganda and advertising and socialisation through capitalism, which encourages you to think that you grab the best you can get and kick the others off the ladder. In fact, people don't find that very natural. and they do have to find ways of justifying it, or they find ways of making themselves feel better about the fact that other people are living in worse conditions than they are. So if anything, I think that should give us some hope by showing that even under capitalism, people don't find capitalism entirely inevitable and natural, but they think at least that there needs to be some excuse, or there needs to be some mediation, or whatever it might be. I mean, in general, I think it's true that in different societies that are organised very differently, people are going to think and feel differently. The sort of attitude and behaviour that would be entirely admired in a feudal kingdom in the Middle Ages would probably get you locked up today in capitalism. You can't go around armed starting fights if people insult you, threatening them with a sword. That would be entirely moral if you're a 12th century nobleman, but it would be frowned on now. I mean, even a duke who did it would be frowned on. So attitudes do change and develop with society. But of course, it's not quite as straightforward as that. As that you just have the attitudes that are appropriate to the kind of society that you're living in. Because if that were true, then we wouldn't be here thinking about socialism, and the people with the Gore-Tex clothes wouldn't be worried about the Gore-Tex clothes. It is possible to think of ways in which society could be made better or social problems could be solved. I think as far as working class politics is concerned, and this up to a point connects to the Labour Party and other things that have been mentioned, that your class interest, if you're a worker in capitalism, is to abolish capitalism and bring about socialism. But your day-to-day experience is of a world where the capitalist rules apply, where if you get the job, then it means maybe I didn't get it, and there is competition and so on. So even if you challenge capitalism or you're not happy with the status quo, you can either challenge it from a position of completely rejecting it, or you can challenge it from a position of a sectional interest within it, and treat the working class as a sectional interest within capitalism that would like to get a bigger slice of the cake or whatever, in the same sort of way that there might be any other sectional lobby. And that, I think, is where something like social democracy comes from, that it's a sectional lobby for working class interests within capitalism rather than a politics that aims to replace capitalism with something different.
Just wonder if I could use sort of chair's privilege for me to chip in on something. It was one of the points you made in your talk about, and the example you used was when Trump made that comment, and there was the gasp, and then the laugh, and then the applause, and the emotional response was the sort of the most obvious response rather than any sort of rational response. And I suppose with a lot of sort of discourse, there's an emotional response to something that's said or something that happens or something we see on the news, and then there's a rational response as well, where we maybe not quite so immediate, but we might think behind, oh, you know, that's happened because of this, or I agree with this because of that. So I was just wondering what your views were on. I don't think they're sort of mutually exclusive, having an emotional response to something which strikes a chord and a rational response. You can have both. And it seems as if the sort of an emotional response from us is more immediate, it's more personal, it sort of tugs at part of us which, you know, we can't quite find the words for, we can't quite put a finger on. And a rational response, you know, takes a bit of time for us to ponder over, weigh up the pros and cons, consider things a bit more widely. And I think that there can be sort of a happy medium where we, you know, those two coexist. And I suppose that's what we want, really. Something that we rationally agree with once we've sat down and weighed it up, but something that sort of strikes a favourable emotional chord with us as well. So I suppose that with any kind of viewpoint or belief, we're maybe sort of hoping for some sort of equilibrium, if you like, between those two sort of ways of looking at the issue. So yeah, I was just wondering what your sort of views were on any sort of competition, if you like, between an emotional response to, you know, an action or something we hear compared with the rational. But yeah, I'll was it Bill, did you have your hand up again? Yeah. Right.
Just stop break that. A slightly different approach to possible. The dad was recently going around, taking around the cathedral, which one, and there was a doorway in it, an archway, which he was told the designers said, well, the builders had purposefully built it so that it wasn't actually complete until quite a few years after the cathedral was finished, and they actually settled and then pushed the various bits of lintel down. So this was a cathedral that took about 100 years to build and even more years to settle, and the people building it had acted in this way knowing it would be impossible for them to see the fruits of their labour in the course of action. And I just think this is relevant because I've always had this kind of sneaky suspicion that we won't see socialism in my lifetime. as we understand it, for a while I thought, I'll get to 40 and I'll go do something more useful. Then I got to 40 and decided not to.
Any more? Oh, yep.
It's my first time here as well, so thanks very much for having me here. It's a real privilege. I'd like to ask the speaker, going back to your original points about belief systems, what is your opinion on the appeal of socialism and the impossibilist tradition as a belief system? By comparison with two of the points that you brought up in your talk. Firstly, the conspiracy theorists and how they are maybe stigmatized outgroups, and perhaps that gives them some sense of impetus or some sort of motivation to maintain their belief systems. And secondly, you were talking about the ERG and Brexit and how perhaps by analogy, if there were a socialist government to be elected, would the instinct be to say, well, that's not true socialism, that's not what I was talking about? So I guess I'm talking about, I'm just asking, why would people want to believe in something impossible, which I think is kind of quite a good point.
Anyone else? Oh, yeah, Patty again.
I just wanted to say about, for me it's about demanding kind of a sense of what's congruous, and so a lot of people on these walks or whatever, not kind of banging on about that, but, it's all right to want justice and equality and a level playing field and whatever, but as long as I'm gaining something, if I'm brought up a notch or I'm going down a notch, that seems to be one kind of angle of it. But, it's got to, like with a lot of things, begin with me, hasn't it? What am I doing? And am I kind of like walking the walk and talking the talk, what can I do? For me, in part of what I do, in offering a service to other people. You know, I can do things like sliding scale things so that I am making my service more accessible to people who couldn't otherwise afford it. You know, and that's kind of what I mean. It's about really making it a personal response to this rather than, you know, when somebody said, you know, what can I do to take practical steps myself to make this inevitable or achievable or whatever, you know, it has to be concrete for us, doesn't it? And that's what I mean about the congruity.
Anyone else? Do you want to maybe wrap up and sort of cover those sort of points as well? Is that okay?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks very much, everybody. Very wide-ranging discussion. Not because it had a rambling introduction. The introduction was focused like a laser beam. I will reply to a couple of those and maybe just say one or two other things, and then we can call it a night. Relationship between emotional and rational responses to things. I mean, I suspect at a certain level, any worldview is driven by an emotional sense of how the world is. And your responses to things are emotional. But it then is logically structured. You want to work out how things come to be that way or how you come to feel that they are that way, and to come up with something that at least feels consistent and reasonable. And the same emotional response or the same emotional stimulus can lead to very different logical structures on top of it. For example, if you're confronted with the fact that people might live in extreme poverty, if you hear about people facing the Ebola outbreak in Central Africa, or people who die in the Mediterranean trying to get to Europe. Well, one possible response to that would be to think it's unacceptable that people should have to live in those conditions. We need to change the way society works. Another response might be, you know, forget about social systems. I should donate some money to Oxfam. Something like that, to help those people. Another response might be, well, I really hope it's not me or my kids. Let's keep them out. So the same stimulus of, you know, look how horrific the situation is that these people are in, can lead to very different consequences. Impossible to see the fruits of our labour or socialism in our lifetime. There's a saying, isn't there, about how a good society is one where old men plant trees that they know they'll never sit in the shade of. Maybe you can apply the same to not old, but people in their prime, hand out leaflets for a social system they know they'll never live in. Do you remember a friend of mine, almost the first time I ever spoke to him, he said almost out of the blue, you know, the first thing we need to know is that we will all live and die under capitalism. And I thought, my God, this guy gets it. And actually, now I know him better, I'm not sure he does get it, but that was a moment of insight. And yeah, we have to recognise that, because if the changes that you want are minor changes, if what you really want is a park and ride bus system in your town, then you might well live to see it. You might not, but you might live to see it. But if what you want is a fundamental change, a change from a society with class division and exploitation and an oppressive class state and division into nations and all the rest of it, to a society that does not have those things, then this is a massive historical process. This is comparable to, and the only revolution in the past that is comparable to it, is the Neolithic Revolution leading to the Urban Revolution, the transition from hunting and gathering to farming and herding, with the resultant development of cities and states and class division, which is something that took not generations but millennia. And there must have been there must have been people through that who spent their lives trying to domesticate the gazelle and they never got anywhere. Or who spent their time arguing, we could have cities or we could have kingdoms or whatever. I mean, it's not an exact parallel, but it's an enormous historical process. And no, we are probably not. Probably. We are probably not going to live to see that process happen in our lifetimes. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not worth trying to bring it about, trying to contribute to that historic process. I mean, even the transition from feudalism to capitalism took centuries, and that is a smaller. It took centuries, and it took not just political action, but new ideas in philosophy and art, which we call the Renaissance, new ideas in religion, and so on. So this is a bigger change than that. I mean, it's not all going to happen quickly. The appeal, Comrade asked about the appeal of socialism in the impossibilist tradition as a belief system. Can I say more limited than I wish it were? I mean, I don't think the appeal is specifically the idea that it's impossible, but the appeal of rejecting possibilisms that turn out not, like I was saying, a shortcut that doesn't go where you're going, which turns out not to be a shortcut after all. But that's bringing back to general topics. So I'll just maybe to wrap up. I mean, Comrade said something, an analogy that I'm not quite athletic enough to follow about windsurfing. And I'm not quite sure whether it ended up saying that we should cooperate with capitalism, in which case I don't agree with it.
Can I just address what I think you...
No, sorry, we can carry on discussion in the bar afterwards, but we'll let Edmund finish.
It's absolutely head-on, you should feel the wind rather than head-to-head.
Yeah, where I thought it was going to go is that in fighting against capitalism, it's important to understand how capitalism actually works, and how it's actually likely to develop, and how society actually functions. so that you're not wasting energy trying to achieve things that are impossible in the unconstructive sense of impossible. And that's partly what I mean by demanding the inevitable. That it, by demanding the inevitable, by basing your politics on an understanding of how capitalism in fact works, you are cutting with the grain, so to speak. Now, getting from here to socialism is, as I've said, a giant historical process. It's not something that's quick anyway. But you can hack at it and scrag it about, or you can cut with the grain. There's a story from one of the Chinese philosophers of a butcher or something who'd been butchering meat for 18 years and had never had to sharpen his cleaver once. And they said to him, "How come you've never had to sharpen your cleaver once?" And it was because he knew so well where every thread of muscle went and where every bone was and where every sinew was, or every little bit of gristle was. So he wasn't hacking at it, but he knew exactly where you could just slide the blade through and it would just come apart, as it were, naturally. And I think that's related to demanding the inevitable as well. Because those gaps where you could get the blade through, those are there inevitably. He didn't choose that they would be there. He couldn't cut it into any arbitrary shapes or joints that he wanted, but he knew exactly how to cut it. To cut it based on how it inevitably was, so it would just fall apart under the axe. And that, I suppose, is what demanding the inevitable ought to be like, or what arguing for the inevitable ought to be like. That because we are not making up fantasies, but we are cutting with the grain of world history, which I think we are, over the very long historical period, from the cave paintings to the present day, there is a trajectory that can be understood. There is a succession of ways in which society has been organised before the development of classes in the state, and then with classes in the state. And the next stage, we hope, will be to transcend classes in the state. And by arguing or by campaigning for a socialist system that actually solves the most fundamental problems of capitalism, the best we can identify them, and the best we can describe a way of just sliding through them, so that we get the natural, inevitable solution, then that still might not be easy and it still might not be quick. But my anticipation is that that's going to be easier and quicker than any other route out of capitalism that you might come up with. So before I just start sermonising, that's probably a reasonable enough point to thank you all again for coming along, and to thank those who've taken part in the discussion. I'm sure we can carry it on over a drink, but thanks very much, and I will shut up for the time being.
And thank you very much.